Radio Rashi welcomes you back to part two in our series of Floyd Norman interviews.
I was able to write this wonderful, I should call it my story wonderful, only wonderful because of these great characters. It was a comic story. I used to write what was known as the Disney Holiday Story.
Oh, I remember those.
It used to be known as the Disney Christmas Story, but yeah.
They ran in papers, right?
They ran in a newspaper,
right.
I would write them every November, December. And I think they would wrap up on Christmas Day.
There's one about Maleficent, wasn't there? Or like her hench goons or something?
We did stories on... Some of the stories were bizarre because I didn't like the way they mixed characters.
Uh-huh.
They would mix Disney characters, like, for instance, they would have Dumbo and Mr. Toad.
Oh, that's a strange mashup.
And Chip and Dale, and they would have these weird Disney mashups. Yeah. And I just found them bizarre. So I said, I can't write this stuff. I said, if I'm going to do a Dalmatian story, it's going to be all the characters from Dalmatian.
Right.
And if I do a Lion King story, it's going to be all the characters from Lion King.
Right, instead of the Dalmatians and Peter Pan. What are
yeah,
you doing?
I'm not going to do the Dalmatians and Peter Pan or Alice. This is getting too weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a bunch of those for King Features Syndicate over the years. And it was always the Disney holiday stories, which was essentially a Christmas story. Well, and one of the weirdest stories I ever had to write, I still laugh about it, I had to do the Aladdin Christmas story. Which still cracks me up. I don't know why. it's Christmas
in
Aladdin.
Baghdad, sort of.
Christmas in Baghdad.
Yeah,
I guess the closest thing I've ever seen to that would be the pantomimes they watch in the UK. It's like, you know, like they celebrate Christmas with that, but it's never.
Yeah. Or the Lion King. I did a Lion King Christmas story.
Where they put Simba on the tree like an ornament. They stood on the edge of the thing and they just hung him on the tree.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's no Christmas on the belt. There are no people on the belt.
I don't know what I did, but I would have to find a way to make these stories work. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the easiest one I ever did was The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Because at least I had a big church to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
I was on safe ground.
Do they still do
Sanctuary.
No, they don't. We stopped doing them somewhere in the 90s.
Well, that's a shame.
Where King Features, I did them for years, which is really weird. I wrote stories, and it was really cool because they pretty much let me write anything I wanted, mm-hmm. as long as I didn't offend anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you had a building of 100 lawyers deciding whether or not what you had
written
was offensive,
that's
right?
That's
hard.
We didn't quite have 100 in those days, but we had enough.
Yeah.
But you got the Brer Rabbit story through then.
Yeah, you know what? And they weren't going to... They were. There was a lot of static about it, and they were not going to run it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, I think they should meet the author.
Yeah.
Because they said that the story was racially insensitive.
Oh.
And they said, you should meet the guy who wrote it. You know,
why don't you just come down and shake Floyd's hand?
So once they saw me, it was like it was Tex Avery time. The jaw hits the floor.
Ooga.
Yeah. I've often wondered if there had been more black directors and animators who back in the 40s, if they had worked on Song of the South or some of Bob Clampett's more outrageous cartoons.
Yeah.
If that would have been easier going for those films in later years, you know,
I don't know. You know, it's really interesting. We used to do a thing up in Oakland. This was years ago, but we had it was an organization called it was a Black Filmmakers Awards Ceremony, mm-hmm. and one year they invited Leo Sullivan and myself to mm-hmm. receive an award.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, I don't know why we even got the award. But,
okay. well, never mind but, that then.
But,
let's move
but,
on.
they asked Leo, who would you like to have to present the award? And Leo said, I'd like to have the guy who gave me my first job. He thought that would be really cool. And he said, that's Bob Clampett.
Wow.
And they said, great, we'll fly him up.
Mm-hmm.
So Bob Clampett and his family flew up to San Francisco because Bob was going to go on stage and present the award to my pal, Leo Sullivan. And keep in mind now, this is like 1979, Oakland, California, predominantly black audience.
Mm-hmm.
I was being born down the street.
Really? Great. Well, anyway, they introduce Bob Clampett, the famous Warner Brothers director, the guy who had directed Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Clampett got a standing ovation. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I hear the fact that, you know, that black people are offended by these cartoons, you know, I don't know. I explain that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked on the first animated version of Fat Albert, was that right?
Yeah, but only as a stealth employee.
Oh, okay.
What does that mean?
I was not really employed. I was working on the film. Actually, it was a TV special.
Mm-hmm.
But as a non-employee, I had worked with, once again, this goes back to Leo Sullivan, mm-hmm. my longtime partner and friend. We had developed this animated thing with the hopes to showing it to Bill Cosby. Because we heard that Bill Cosby wanted to do a Fat Albert thing on television.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got one of Bill Cosby's records, Wonderfulness, I recall the title now.
Mm-hmm.
And we did some animation to Cosby's tracks,
mm-hmm.
audio tracks, and we animated some stuff. We thought we'd show this stuff to Bill Cosby. He'd be really impressed and give us a job and pay us lots of money. Well, it turns out that we got there too late because a colleague of ours named Ken Mundy had already approached Bill Cosby and made a deal to do the Fat Albert special.
Curse you, Ken.
But it all worked out because my friend Leo got hired onto the project and as an animator, story guy, layout artist. It was one of those things where all the artists did everything, which is really cool.
Because
all the artists worked on story, worked on layout, worked on animation, and believe it or not, even painted the cells.
Wow.
True story. It was like filmmakers do everything.
That's a lot.
You don't do one job like, you know, as in most studios, everybody has their little category they fit in.
Mm-hmm.
On this job, everybody would do everything, which is, I thought, a really cool idea.
And kind of fun for you.
And kind of fun.
Imagine, yeah.
But, of course, I didn't get hired.
Oh.
Because I was working over at ABC on a really bad TV show, and that kept me busy during the day. And I was part of the writing staff on a show that shall remain nameless.
Okay.
No, it won't. It was called Turn On. Produced by George Slaughter and Digby Wolf and Fred Friendly.
Slaughter was on Laugh-In, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, George Slaughter produced Laugh-In.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do a show over at ABC
mm-hmm.
Called Turn On.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be even more outrageous than Laugh-In. It was going to be really irreverent. We were going to focus on everything that we shouldn't talk about or make fun of, and that was politics, religion, and sex.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And that's what got us kicked off the air. On our first show, show number one, canceled.
Turned off.
No.
We set a precedent. ABC canceled us while we were on the air.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
an edict just came down from on high and said game over.
The show was on the air, and we were at the party, the rap party or the whatever it was.
The premiere party. Yeah.
The premiere party. Mm-hmm. We were at the bistro in Beverly Hills celebrating when we got the word that our show was canceled.
We were on
the air and we were dead.
Oh, how morose.
This was back to the bartender, another round for the house.
For these freshly unemployed gentlemen.
Yeah, I'll take the bottle to go.
Yeah, right. Can I have this to go, please?
Two small bottles of whiskey.
So. But anyway, it was during that process of working on Turn On that I used to drive over to the Bill Cosby studio and jump in and pick up a paintbrush and help my colleagues finish their show. I was not employed there. I was just helping out.
Fun?
So I worked on the Fat Albert special by being a guest artist.
Okay.
Or a derelict artist or something. But
an unpaid artist.
I remember.
Yeah, and unpaid.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
But free donuts.
Okay.
Free donuts.
I would also work coffee. For donuts. Yeah. I would. Yeah. I would do that. Yes.
I remember that special had a very unique and dynamic look to it.
It did. It did. And we owe that to Ken Mundy, who came up with that idea.
And then I was very disappointed when it got to be a regular series and it looked like
became Saturday morning television.
The grit and the soul and the spirit of it seemed to just sort of vanish out of it, and it was very.
Yeah.
Homogenized.
That's what happens, you know. The television can be disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Although we had fun on Turn On, and I was going to mention that one of our writers on our illustrious writing staff, I don't know what happened to the rest of our staff or what happened to me for that matter. but
you're here having potatoes. Salad.
But one of our talented young writers was a kid named Albert Einstein.
Huh.
Who went on to have a career.
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit of one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Changed his name.
A little bit.
He changed his name, and he did okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, but boy, we still got canceled. Let's
blame Al.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's blame him.
Let's blame him.
Mr. Brooks. Uh-huh. Thank you so much.
Curse you, Albert Brooks. Yeah.
We went to a Passover Seder a few years ago, and we go around the table and you all read parts of the Passover.
We lost our seats when they found out we weren't Jews.
Yes, they kicked us out. Ooh, we got canceled halfway through the Seder.
We got canceled halfway through the Seder.
Neither of you is Jewish? It's like,
Another little bit of Manischewitz, please.
How could you tell? I was always baffled by this. How do you tell?
Well, we didn't know what the hell we were doing there, for one.
Well, for instance, when I walk into a room, they usually notice that I'm the black guy. So how do you know when the Jewish guy walks in?
I don't know. Maybe Jews smell different. I don't know. That's what I was asking you. How Walt Disney smelled? He didn't smell Jewish, did he?
No.
No, I'm just kidding. That's totally
like
ignorant.
Cigarettes, but
yeah. No, but I don't. I mean, halfway through it, what ended up happening was she found. I mean, that's a very limited number of seats. It's a family gathering.
Yeah.
And it's a religious event. And she thought I was Jewish when we first got married. I don't know why. Like she.
Stankievich.
Stankievich, yeah, that was my maiden name, was Stankievich.
Oh,
but
great.
It's not W-I-T, it's not Stankowitz, it was Stankievich, K-I-E-W-I-C-Z. So, it's Austrian, it's not, regardless, for whatever reason, Arlene Sorkin, who's a good friend of ours, had invited us over for this. And then she went, wait, at the end of the evening, she was like, I thought you were Jewish. And I said, no. And she was like, oh, well, then get out.
No, she didn't at all.
She was not like that. She's lovely and gracious. But that was
I think she just wanted us over because it was more like a family thing. Like,
it was pretty fun.
Meet our extended family, which included Albert Brooks doing the 40 years we're in the desert. But we couldn't
have. Because there's a read. You know, like you read, you go around the table and you read.
You bet.
Yeah, it was hysterical.
And I'm sitting there just praying, no Hebrew. I don't want to.
Because they assign verses. I don't know if you've ever been to one, but you get assigned lines and you read out loud at the table.
Yeah,
I've been to a Seder.
Yeah,
yeah,
but I don't think I had to read anything.
Well, they sometimes do a more formal thing. This was a formal thing where they even have a little fountain of wine.
The Manischewitz, yeah.
And you
squirted out grapes and into your glass.
I've gone to several Seders, and I always request to play the part of the ignorant son because, you know, I don't know anything about what's going on.
Right.
It's sort of like our friend
of ours.
Which is
why you're always invited once.
Once, yeah. And
that's it.
A friend of ours was decorating the Christmas tree, and she's Jewish, and she goes, here? And we go, yeah, that's fine.
Just, oh, yeah, Ruth. Yeah. Oh,
right on the tree. That's fine.
Oh,
but,
that's good.
You know, they range from big events, and this was like a big event.
Yeah, there was like 60 people there.
You know, come in and have some matzo and, you know, drink some wine.
It was really nice.
It was fun. It was great. It was
really
great.
Fun family gathering. Very good people. Very nice. It was a really good time. But we had no idea what we were doing there. And I've never been to one before or since.
Albert Brooks.
So the one I've ever attended was attended by Albert Brooks and the creator of Mad TV. Yes, let's
there
do
you
those.
Go. There
yes, because if you're going to do it once.
Albert Brooks does the world's funniest ventriloquist act. He had this act called Dan and Dave, Dan and Dave, where he came out.
Uh-huh.
And he had the dummy with him, and it's like, well, Danny, here we are on TV. And it's like, right, Dave? And like that, like he just he opens the dummy's mouth at random points, and he never changes the voice, and he just, it's the world's worst ventriloquist act, and it just gets funnier and funnier as it goes along. You know, it's like they should not allow puppets anymore because he sort of put a nail in
just ruin them
in the concept. Yeah, it was pretty good. So
I met Edgar Bergen.
Oh yeah,
stop it.
Because he was a friend of Walt Disney.
Stop. Oh, there you go.
You know,
oh,
I mean, you know, wow. Walt had certain pals and who would come to the studio, and Bergen was one of the pals. You know, Walt. You know, he knew a few people in Hollywood. I think Spencer Tracy was a friend, and who else?
And they just drop by to hang out. And
well, they would stop in on occasion, because you know they were buddies with Walt. So it was like it was wild because I remember Bergen had Charlie McCarthy in a trunk or in a suitcase. He had the suitcase.
Always with him.
Yeah, like maybe he carries Charlie around in case he needs him. But
hence Candace's deep resentment.
Oh my, yeah. That's back when she was still called Candy.
Yeah. I know
not
that
anymore.
Now my mother is from Santa Barbara also, and she remembers that Walt was part of a group. I want to say like the Vaqueros or something, but they would do a ride.
A ride, that's right.
And they would ride in like old California outfits through the hills, and they would meet for dinner, and it was like an annual ride.
My boss did that.
Yes.
My former boss, Bill Wagon, was a member of that group, and they were all like wannabe cowboys.
Yeah.
And they would once a year do this ride. You know, they would put on their cowboy garb and their boots, and they'd get their horses, and they would go riding around the Santa Ynez Valley or wherever, you know. I never quite got it because, well, I'm not a cowboy. But they were really into that stuff.
See, that's what makes Walt kind of a fun guy. He would do this stuff like that. He'd go on trains. There's that story about him taking Walt Ward Kimball off to a train convention
something like that. And that great story where Walt beats the stuffing out of a drunk on the train.
What?
That
what?
Joe Grant
story.
Oh, you
I
never
don't know
heard
this
that story?
Story?
Walt's daughter verifies this story.
Wow.
It was told by Joe Grant.
Oh, awesome.
Walt and Joe had to take a trip back to Washington, D.C. This was during the war.
Okay.
When Walt had government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
He had to
He was doing the morale films, like the Donald
that kind of stuff.
Films.
Yeah, the taxes and training for war and all that stuff. And Joe Grant and Walt had to make a trip back to Washington, D.C., and they did it on the train.
Uh-huh.
They were going to take the train back, and so Walt had a private car.
Uh-huh.
So he and Joe could work on the storyboards and stuff as they traveled. It just made sense. And there was this drunk guy who kept barging into Walt's private car. And he goes, "Oh, sorry, I'm in the wrong place, I guess." And Walt was, "Get out of here, we're trying to work." This sounds like a routine, like a comedy routine.
Yeah,
totally.
And so
Mark's
they're back
brothers.
At work, and the guy wanders again. "Oh, is this the right car?" You know.
Oh, like,
we're trying to work. Get out of here.
I went the other way confided.
It's like Preston Sturges, the Palm Beach story with all the drugs shooting up the bar car.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is Joe Grant telling this story.
Yeah.
And so finally, the drunk comes in the third time. It had to be the third time, naturally.
It's
got to be the third
time.
Funny,
yes.
And Walt says, "Come with me." And they leave. And Joe is what they call it, a room, not stateroom.
The private, sleeper.
The private room.
Yeah.
And he's there, and he says, "Gee, I wonder what Walt is doing. Is he talking to the guy?" So Joe peeks outside the car, and he sees Walt Disney beating the crap out of this car.
Oh, my God!
That's got to be the funniest Walt Disney story I ever heard.
And, did he toss him off the train?
And Joe Grant claims it's true. No, he didn't toss him off the train.
Come with me, he said.
But Joe claims it's true. And Diane, Walt's daughter, said that she heard the same story from her father. So I gather it's true.
Walt Disney, two-fisted cartoonist.
That, don't mess with Walt.
No.
He's got a brush in one hand and a can of whoop-ass in the other. There you go.
There you go. Mild-mannered Uncle Walt will just beat the crap out of you.
Oh, was he mild-mannered? Was he, like, heavy-footed and aggressive?
Oh, I wish he had done it in Mickey's voice.
Take that, you bastard! Take that. Get off the train, drunkie!
I'm gonna knock you in the next week.
Oh, no, you're not!
Oh, that's great.
And then he wrote the next Pete cartoon.
Well, yeah. Then there, I wonder if that was around the time they did that cartoon, Mr. Mouse Takes a Trip, you know, where he's, he's fighting Pete on the train.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Oh, that's, God, that's great. That's,
so was he genuinely pretty mild-mannered to work with? I mean, obviously, if he loved something, he loved it. If he hated it, he hated it. But was he generally polite?
You know, I wasn't around during the early days with feisty young Walt. Keep in mind, I got to Disney kind of late in the game when a lot of the animators and the old story guys and Walt himself, you know, they were getting up in years. And they lived they lived life a lot harder in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, you know, they were adults.
Scotch for breakfast.
They were adults, which meant they smoke and they drank and they partied hard.
Poor Freddie Moore. Didn't he fall out of a moving car or something?
Well, I've heard so many stories about poor Freddie, but the story they claim is really true is that there was an auto accident, but Freddie wasn't even driving. His wife was driving, and he hit his head in the crash. So I've heard all these stories about Freddie was drunk driving and all that, but he wasn't even driving the car when the accident happened.
I have one of his girls. Oh. He drew it on acetate and then painted it on the back.
Man. I thought you meant one of his daughters, and I was like, she's locked up.
He would do drawings of Freddie Moore. Girls are very distinct. They have very soft, angelic features, little dot eyes. He designed all the girls, I think, in the Casey Returns,
And Casey's daughters. I've got a drawing. I've got one of Freddie's drawings from mm-hmm. Casey's daughters. Yeah, because they're very cute.
Yeah.
And you know about the Penthouse Club, too, right?
No.
Okay. On the third floor, not above the third floor, there was a... Now we're going back doing some Disney history here. Uh-huh. There was an area upstairs called the Penthouse Club. It was basically a gentleman's club. Hmm. On the upper level of the animation building.
Nice.
Men only.
Of course.
Only men.
Except for the women that were invited.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
There you go. But anyway, I was just a kid, so I certainly was not a member of the Penthouse Club and would not have access to it. Except if you got to the studio early enough, you could sneak upstairs. And so one morning I said, I got to go upstairs and see the Penthouse Club. And upstairs I found a bar, really cool bar, and a mural that, you know, covered the walls of the bar of lovely Freddie Moore young women.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Sans clothing.
Yes, well, of course.
Hot damn.
It's a gentleman's club.
I love it all.
Gentleman's club, clothing optional.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting a studio because I not only do I want to make cartoons. Yeah. I would
let you paint naked ladies on the wall in here.
I would certainly.
The way I paint naked ladies, yes.
Well, no, I would let Floyd paint naked ladies on the wall in here.
No, I don't know how to draw.
Oh, no.
Can't draw like Freddie Moore. His girls were really cute. Really cute.
Well, they're adorable. Would you tell the muffin story, please?
The Muffin Story?
Yes, that's one of my favorite drawings, and I would love to run that if we could on our site as a way.
Yeah, true story from
that shot. You have a knack for drawing Walt Disney in that picture where he looks almost like Mr. Spacely from the.
Walt always looked grumpy. Now he wasn't a grumpy man at all, but he did have that persona. Mm-hmm. And it all started, if you see the movie Saving Mr. Banks, you'll know that Walt had two secretaries, Tommy and the other one whose name I can't remember now. But very marvelous, sweet young women. Mm-hmm. Well, one was older, one was younger. And they would run Walt's office. Mm-hmm. And so you get a chance to know them. Mm-hmm. And I would go up, I would arrive at the studio early, and I would go up to Walt's office. Why I was in Walt's office, I don't even remember why. What was I doing there? in the boss's office. But I was anyway. I was up in Walt's office.
Maybe you were creeping around, like he creeped around in your office, tit but for it, tat, you know?
Not the inner office, but the outer office, because his secretaries were there. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that on the shelf there was some bran muffins. And I said, you know, why are these bran muffins here? And they said, oh, the commissary brings them over every morning for Walt. And sometimes he eats them and sometimes he doesn't, you know. And I said, well, what happens if he doesn't eat them? And they said, well, we throw them in the trash. And I said, well, gee, that seems like a waste. I'll tell you what, if Walt doesn't eat them, can I have them? Mm-hmm. And they said, sure, fine, you know. When Walt comes in, he'll either grab a muffin or he won't. And if he doesn't, if he doesn't take one, then you're welcome to have it or have them both. So, great. So I did this for a few weeks. I'd sneak up to Walt's office. The muffins were gone. That's cool. That meant Disney ate the muffins. They were still sitting there. It meant Walt came in, didn't want a muffin, left them. They were up for grabs. So I did this for a while. And then one morning I went upstairs and saw the muffins sitting there. And I ate them. And then Walt showed up, looking for his muffins.
Oh, no.
And I had eaten them.
You said, they in my belly. You're going to have to get them out of my belly.
I didn't say anything.
You went, mm-hmm.
I left, and I never touched the muffins again.
Oh, hey now.
Yeah. But
boss's muffins.
True story. Mm-hmm. True story. I ate Walt Disney's brand muffins until I stopped.
Until you didn't anymore.
Until
yes.
I didn't anymore. Yeah.
We didn't want to upset him and make him take you out back to the railroad.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, really. Floyd, come with me on the train.
Okay, so we actually had some fans write in when they found out you were coming, and we've got a couple of... I have tons of questions for you still, so are you okay?
I'm. Oh, yeah, I will answer any questions.
Okay, cool.
Including one from my wife here.
When are you coming home?
When are you coming home?
They chained me up. I'm never allowed to leave because they said the... The wife says she loves me and I can't come home ever. Misty will not release me ever. Because you're going to live here. We built you a beautiful bedroom studio, nicer than ours. And you are now stuck here forever.
Wonderful.
I have to say, there's something kind of wonderfully horrifying about your caricature of Michael Eisner. And there was like these two perfect ovals, one for his forehead and the other one for his cheeks. And he always had this weird, frightening little grin on his face.
It took us a while to get that.
But once you nailed it, you nailed it. And
yeah, once we got it, we had Michael. And, you know, but, you know, to give him credit, he was a good guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a lot of gags about Michael Eisner. And he took it very well.
Well, he was the one thing that I felt that the other studios always lacked in particular. I mean, I had a very good experience working for nearly 15 years at Warner Brothers, but the more they tried to diversify into things like feature films, you know, once Lion King made money, everybody wanted to make money.
Oh, yeah.
They really, and every other studio for a long time needed a Michael Eisner because Michael seemed to have a little bit of, or, you know, a fair share of what Walt had, is like figure out what your people are good at and have them do that. And also, you know, you may not want to see Little Mermaid 2 or something, but we'll make damn sure you know it exists on DVD or video if you want to see it.
You bet we will.
And and the things like that, and that's where I think everybody else failed, is where, and Disney kept, you know, and now I think, I think they're still far out of everybody else, and DreamWorks can kind of match them, and Blue Sky, I think the field has become more diversified.
Oh, yeah.
But while Michael was there, Disney was a clear odds-on winner, and nobody could touch them.
Exactly,
as far as the vision of a unified product.
And, you bet, yeah. And it was also Frank Wells balanced Michael Eisner.
Yeah, so
I've heard. And so that dynamic totally changed when Frank was killed in the helicopter accident, and that was tragic. Mm-hmm. But That sort of sent the studio spiraling down as well.
Yeah.
Once we lost that, because Michael, unrestrained by Frank, you know, I don't know, things just weren't working.
It also seemed like Frank was an important buffer between Michael and Jeffrey.
I think so too. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, mm-hmm. The things heated up between Michael and Jeffrey, and that was unfortunate. Because I actually liked Jeffrey. I thought he was good for the studio.
Uh-huh.
And under Jeffrey's leadership, boy, we sure didn't do badly.
No,
I mean, yeah. Disney produced hit after hit.
Mm-hmm. He brought
that was
a
Mermaid
focus.
Era, yeah. The Lion King era,
Beauty and the Beast, yeah. Aladdin, Lion King. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've said this kind of facetiously, but I think. There's some sort of truth in it also that when I look at Lion King, you know, like Jeffrey was very much involved with that. That's a predator story. That's a story that a predator could tell. And maybe if an artist was telling that story, it's kind of like a businessman story about noblesse oblige and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And almost like a corporate telling of a fairy tale. Whereas an artist might be more with the hero or the underdog story, but
yeah.
But when I saw The Lion King, I thought it was a very interesting take that the in cartoons the mouse is always the hero. The carnivore is always the guy falling off the cliff.
That's right.
And
that's right.
So it became a very interesting. That was where I felt like the vision of corporate and the vision of artists and the storyteller kind of matched each other very well.
Yeah, that movie was supposed to fail. Lion King was going to be Disney's...
Springtime for Hitler?
Yeah, it was going to be a real disaster. Uh-huh. And I really hadn't... I had looked at the film only in storyboard form, and I really didn't know that much about it. And I didn't really pay that much attention to it, because at the time, it seemed like there were other things going on that were more interesting. But I recall they had a screening, and it was only... the opening sequence. That's all they showed, or at least that's all I saw.
Right.
It was that opening sequence with that song and where I guess all the animals are gathering at Pride Rock to see the new baby who's the heir apparent, you know, mm-hmm. and holding up the baby. And that thing had such power, you know, and mm-hmm. when they did the song and then bam!
The
title comes on, yes. The Lion King, and it just like knocked me out of my chair, and I said, "Whoa!" You know, I don't care what follows this; it's a great movie. Yeah, you got me already. I'm on board.
They showed that was the trailer that they
yeah,
showed
and
too.
Then they used it as a trailer,
and it was all they needed,
and it was just like,
and everybody
that's
went,
all,
"Yep, that, I'll be there.
I'm going to see it.
I'll be there.
I am RSVPing from this seat right now. I will see you when it next year. Yes, I'll be there.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember
2 years before that they had an open house over at Disney Animation that I went to,
mm-hmm.
where it was Christmas time and they gave everybody like a mug or something like that.
Yeah,
where they had an open house and they showed things that were in development. And I guess it was the year Aladdin had come out or what was coming soon. And they had some of the development artwork for Lion King up. And I remember the thing that really struck me, and this is actually in the movie, in Scar's song with the hyenas.
Be prepared.
Be prepared. Mm-hmm. There was a shot of the hyenas marching in formation.
Yes.
In silhouette.
Yeah.
And I remember the setup from a Leni Riefenstahl movie about, I think it's from The Sorrow and the Pity. It's about Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And they had done the shots deliberately of the hyenas turning and kind of marching in that formation. And I go, Leni Riefenstahl, hyenas in front of a lion leader. I'm there. I don't.
Yeah.
This is going to be a great movie because you can see the political dynamics and the fact that they were doing something like that. That wasn't cuddly rabbits trying to get away from a predator or something. It was like it just demanded your attention. And I said, "I'm gonna." And that was a year before I saw the Lion King opening. It was just like there's a fun and unique vision that's guiding the company at this point.
Yeah,
and that was all through the '90s. Was they really had a resurgence, especially those first 5 years.
Yeah, so you could feel it.
Yeah. So Floyd, for you, where was your, like, if you, and I know that you're still working a lot and doing all this stuff, but where was your buoyancy period where you were like, God, this is the funnest thing. Like looking back, what was your joy project or what would be, you know, like which one was the most fun or was there a group of years or a reason why, like just really precious gem in your jewel box?
You know, I don't know because every decade is different.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like trying to choose what was the most fun,
uh-huh.
because every project was somewhat unique. I think Jungle Book is special only because that was the one movie that I worked on with the old man himself, mm-hmm. with Walt Disney. And that wasn't even supposed to happen. Like I said, that was just dumb luck that I got chosen to work on that film.
That was mad
skill. I didn't even want to work on the film. I was purposely trying to avoid the Jungle Book, and yet that ended up being the film that probably most defines my career.
Now, why were you purposely trying to avoid that book? Or that
because
show?
I had already worked on a number of feature films.
Okay.
And I was kind of tired of features, and I wanted to do something a little bit different.
Okay.
And I was just looking for anything else to do except another feature. And so when I ended up on the Jungle Book, instead of being elated, and I guess I should have been, I was like, oh, man, mm-hmm. you know, I'm on this stupid feature, and I don't even want to do it, and I didn't even ask for this job. I didn't mm-hmm. want it, you know. So, mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, all your friends are auditioning and failing yeah, to yeah. get the very job.
Everybody
that you've
trying to get in the story
uh-huh.
and can't. I don't want to get in the story, and I just fall into it. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean about life is weird sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, yeah. Jungle Book was like my defining movie when I was a kid. I loved that movie.
Yeah,
and I saw it a dozen times.
Isn't that weird? And Vance and I saw it as probably one of the... just another ordinary movie.
Yeah.
We just saw it as like, well, okay.
It was what you were doing at that time.
Yeah, whatever, you know, no big deal, you know. We
just around 1965, I guess I read The Jungle Book for the first time, 66.
Kipling's
Jungle uh-huh. Book. And I yeah. remember seeing an illustration in a magazine. I think it was Walt Disney did a lot of things with Gulf.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
They were a sponsor of the show, and they had an image I've seen only there and never since of Mowgli in a very primitive form. He's ganglier, he's older, he's much more Asian looking, and he's sitting there with crossed legs and arms staring at Bagheera, who looks a little more pantherish. And I was thinking, that's going to be really cool, because they made Mowgli kind of a badass, you know, like, and it was a preliminary drawing of them yeah. kind of like staring each other down, and I couldn't wait to see the movie. And then I got a comic book adaptation like about a month before the movie came out, and I'm going like, Ka's a bad guy, and there's no Jackal following Shere Khan around, and Baloo's singing a lot. This is not the book I remember. Yeah. And so I was kind of going like, is this really what the movie's going to be about? But I saw the movie, and I was knocked away because the book is great. The movie is its own thing, and the movie is great. It's like The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
The book is very different from the movie,
yeah.
but the movie is undeniably its own thing and mm-hmm. and really wonderful.
Sure, sure.
I remember my dad belonged to a men's club, and Phil Harris was a member of the club. And I got to meet Phil one day, and you know, I was just, nice to meet you, Mr. Harris. My dad says, my kid loves The Jungle Book. Why don't you sing that song with him?
Oh, no.
And he made me sing The Bare Necessities with Phil Harris.
I'm sure both of you were like, is this really happening?
And I swear to God, this happened. And I was like 25 at the time.
You were 25?
I was 25 at the time.
Stop it.
No, I was like 25 or 30.
Oh, my God, I'm thinking you're like 4 years old or something.
No, no. Whoa, my dad is a member of a club in San Francisco called the Bohemian Club. And there are a lot of artists and writers and singers. My dad's a singer. And he said, sing the song with Phil. And he goes, hey, come on, little britches, sing. And I go, bare necessities, simple.
No.
I'm going like, I'm dying.
We just saw Bill Farmer.
And if you want to know what Phil Harris smelled like,
whoa.
Straight bourbon.
Bourbon.
I didn't ask though.
And he's singing in my face, and he's wearing like a 70s leisure suit, and he's singing, and I know the words to the song, you know, like, there's wherever there are bears around, that's where
he's like,
my
I remember there's a lot of slapping.
No, yeah, he's singing some song that where he mentions the word bear every once in a while. My dad's going like, sing, Paul, sing.
Okay, so we just saw Bill Farmer at a party, and I always feel bad, you know, because I mean, Bill Farmer does the voice of Goofy, and so I always feel bad when somebody goes to a party and they're like, do the thing, and it's like, you know, like people come up to me, do a magic trick, and it's like, they, you know, I mean, every once in a while, if you're inspired. To, you know, like if you were sitting here and I was like, draw a picture of this.
Yeah.
You'd be
yeah.
like, if you wanted to draw, you'd be sitting there doing it. Because that's yeah. what you do when you have a right. pencil in your hand. And you know, like, or like I'll be sitting there doodling or, you know, horsing around. But poor Bill. He's got, you know, like he's just got to pull it out on command. And he genuinely loves to do it. But he does get that sort of like bashful thing. And I always feel sorry for guys that, that have that, like SpongeBob, you know, like we were at the last night with Tom Kenny. Yeah. You know, people are like, oh, just do it, just a little bit.
Just do
bit.
It, do the
you
thing,
know,
do
he's,
it.
He's happy to sign his name on something, but to yeah. just to beg him to do the voice at the, I always feel so bad for those guys. Yeah. So poor yeah. Phil Harris is all I'm trying to say, and his straight bourbon and his leisure suit. I feel sorry for him for all of those reasons.
I feel sorry for me. I had to sing with him. And
you were 25. You should have walked away.
Charles Fleischer wouldn't do Roger Rabbit.
Oh, really?
And I didn't blame him yeah. for mm-hmm. not doing it. I know I didn't blame him. Anyway. Oh. So yeah.
Well, you got to give him a paycheck.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right.
That's what he does for a living.
You know? Oh, you mentioned buoyancy.
Yes.
This is bouncing back into my head now. You mentioned that period when you were buoyant.
Yes.
And there was a period when I was buoyant. It was in 1997 when I went up to Pixar.
Yes, and, that's what
and
I want to ask.
That about was special because it was like beginning again, because at that time Pixar was not the Pixar of today.
Mm-hmm.
It was the new studio, mm-hmm. you know, and it was very exciting. It was a ragtag. It was before Pixar became professional.
Yeah.
Before they became the Pixar of today. It was when Pixar was a ragtag bunch of kids trying to learn how to make movies.
Rebels.
Trying to make it into the big time, trying to be like Disney
mm-hmm.
and actually being better than Disney. And not knowing it, and that was fun. That was a good time.
So did you?
I have to break in.
Oh, okay.
10 years before that.
Okay.
I just have to throw in my own 2 cents here. I was working at Lucasfilm, and I go over to this office where there's this guy John Lasseter animating
yes.
these blobs that are going to become a movie called The Adventures of Andre and Wally B.
And Wally B. Yes.
And I was working at Lucasfilm. He was working there. And we became kind of friendly, you know,
yeah.
like I've since lost contact with him, but I would see him around and I would go over there every once in a while and watch him. And it was like magic to me watching
yeah.
this. And I remember watching, like, they weren't even color. The B was gray and Andre was they were like skeletal figures. And
yeah.
I was watching them bob around. And I said, you know, this is your version of Steamboat Willie.
Yeah.
And he
yeah.
said, I don't know. Hopefully we'll get there. And I remember I would go over every time they did a new short. And it was like insane. It was magic to me. It was him and maybe one other guy just figuring
yeah.
figuring out how to do this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Those early days.
And John would have get-togethers at his house in San Francisco every once in a
mm-hmm.
while. And
mm-hmm.
and everybody was just hoping that this was going to go somewhere. Like it wasn't. George Lucas was doing a lot of experimental things, and he kind of wasn't paying attention to Pixar because he's not a story guy like Walt. He doesn't
yeah.
get in there in the trenches and kind of work in that development stage.
Yeah. And Pixar wasn't making any money anyway.
No,
it was just a money, it was a money drain at that time.
Yeah.
And even Steve Jobs, after he bought the company from George Lucas, it was still just the money loser. And Steve was writing checks just to keep the company alive.
Because he believed in it.
Because he believed that eventually Pixar would one day become something.
And it turned
nobody knew what right. it was going to become, but he figured it would become something.
Yeah.
And it became, a film studio. Who,
it became
who,
something.
Who
yes.
knew? Yeah, who
yeah.
knew?
What was it like working with John Lasseter and Joe Rant back then in those days?
Joe, I knew. I knew Joe. I had worked with Joe at Disney, so he was an old friend. John,
oh.
I didn't know. I didn't know John that well because I was already working at Disney when John was still a student at Cal Arts.
Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of like the kid still in school. And
mm-hmm.
and I really didn't really know these guys because they were all much younger
mm-hmm.
than myself. I got to know Joe Ramp, even though he was around the same age,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little older.
Terrific
but,
story guy.
But Joe was a great storyteller,
yeah.
just a natural storyteller. And so here I was up at Pixar in the late 90s, and I felt something special was going on there. I felt, here I am, and I felt it's like being back at Hyperion in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I missed Hyperion because...
You were a baby.
Hadn't been born yet.
Right.
So I missed it. But here I was at Pixar, and here was the new Disney. You know, and I'm kind of like here at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
This is when all the good stuff is happening. And I remember telling the kids one day, there were a bunch of Pixar artists, and they were in the story room and they were grumbling about something. And I said, guys, you're going to look back and remember you know, the good old days. I said, right now we are living the good old days.
Yeah.
You're going to look back and say, remember back in 1997 when we were, you know, doing this and that, mm-hmm. you know? And so, that's what happens, you know?
2D to 3D all mm-hmm. of a sudden for you.
Yeah.
And I know that you were talking, I think, before we even started recording about what a different animal it is.
It is,
how
yeah.
How is it for you to sort of, you know, like, how were you, because you obviously can transition and go both ways, if you will.
Yeah, it's not a problem, though.
It's not a problem?
It's not a problem for a storyteller, because how you make your movie really doesn't matter, because the story is a story. I mean,
okay.
whether I'm working on a 2D movie or a 3D movie,
uh-huh.
I'm still telling a story. So,
yeah.
So for me, there's no transition.
Okay.
Now, I do know that when the film has to be made, how it's going to be made, now there's an issue. And if you're going to do it hand-drawn, you're going to have to work one way. If you're going to do it on the computer, you're going to have another way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are two different animals. But for us storytellers, we're lucky because we don't have to worry about any of that. People would ask me, how was it working at Pixar? It must have been really different from working at Disney. And I said, no, it was exactly the same.
Interesting.
Because we're still making a movie. We're still telling a story.
Right.
For us storytellers, there's absolutely no difference. Once you start to make the film and you're in production, well, there's a big difference because mm-hmm. that production pipeline is totally different. And the way animators have to work and do their scenes, a totally different mindset. So that's changed radically. And I've talked to animators who've made the transition from hand-drawn to digital, and they said how they had to just kind of unscramble their brain mm-hmm. and learn to think a different way.
Almost like learning to walk again.
Yeah, yeah, because mm-hmm. it's not the same. The way an animator with pencil and paper works, and I've done it, so I know what it feels like and how you think and how you have to design a scene. When you start doing that on the computer, it's like initially you just want to start screaming because mm-hmm. once it's such a total different way of using your brain, using your hands, and it's like you just want to start crying. You know, initially you just want to say, I can't do this and I'm just going to go home and cry. But you have to get into it and say, okay, I know how to do this. Now let me do my job, but I'm going to have to do it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what a hand-drawn animator has to do when they make that move over to digital.
Is it a hard learning process?
It varies. Some guys make the adjustment and make it quickly.
Uh-huh.
Others truly suffer with it.
Mm-hmm.
And some just don't want to do it at all.
That was one of the tragedies I felt that happened, one of the fallout elements of the big animation boom in the early 90s,
yeah.
was that it happened so fast with Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. You had kids. There was this incredible rush of animation and demand for animation.
Yeah.
And kids, you know, entering school in 1990 or 92 and then wanting to be animators, 2D animators coming out, finding it's shutting down.
Oh, yeah.
That now that they have to learn, they have to relearn everything on computer. And you train for 2D because you want to make something like The Lion King.
Yeah.
No, we're all making, you know, Toy Story 3.
Yeah, yeah, we're all working digitally now. I think one of my big regrets is, as a lover of animation, we all think back to the golden age of animation and all of these great Disney guys like Frank Thomas and Milt Kahl,
mm-hmm.
Freddie Moore and Ward Kimball. We think of those names, Ken mm-hmm. Harris. And all of these great animators and doing all this great work. Well, do you know this was happening again? We were training.
There goes Deuce.
There goes. We were training a new generation of animators at Disney, and they were getting better and better with each picture.
Mm-hmm.
The guys like Glenn Keane and Andreas Deja,
sure,
Mark Hinn and Nick Ranieri. These mm-hmm. guys were getting really, really good. And I said, you know what? We're going to have a new generation of 9-0 men. They were working up to that level.
Yeah.
Of a Milt Kahl, of a Frank Thomas.
Right.
They were getting that good. And then they got shut down. And by not having the feature, you know, venue, these guys are not going to grow and develop, because you simply can't do it unless you have that feature film format to work in.
You
got
to do it to work your muscles, sure.
Yeah, you got to do that. It's and like if you don't have that kind of picture to work on, you're no longer going to grow as an animator. Even if you keep working and doing short films and TV commercials and independent films, you can never work to that level again, because it requires a big studio like Disney to be able to carry that film, because animation's so expensive.
Every film is a different, you know, it's problem solving, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You look at, you know, it's easy to look at like a lineup of the characters and see Dumbo standing next to Princess Aurora, but yeah, there's like a different science that goes into a making of a movie like Dumbo, whereas the design and the world of Princess Aurora is completely different.
Well, yeah. Also, you've got the range of motion, because if you're looking at, if you're animating a little elephant who's a little trouncy and the movement is like this, and you're dealing with floppy ears, now all of a sudden you're dealing with a graceful, flowing princess with this long hair that just moves ever so slightly and is never out of place.
Right.
That's a totally different vibe. I was going to ask you a question about being a storyteller.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's a differentiation? I know that you feel that your job is the same because you're telling a story, but do you feel the way that your story is represented on screen is superior in one medium over the other? Do you like to see 2D pictures over 3D pictures, or are they just totally different?
I don't find any difference in the storytelling, you know? Mm-hmm.
So you don't think that it's like something, I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel that a story is more resonant? I mean, a good story is resonant because it's a damn good story and it affects us on a human level.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think what I'm really asking is, do you have a personal preference? Do you think one is prettier than the other? Do you think one is more fun for you?
I tend to like movies that are silly and funny.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I had a preference, would you said, hey, would you like to work on this kind of epic, kind of serious film, or would you like to do this really stupid, silly film?
Mm-hmm.
I would choose the stupid, silly film.
Okay, mm-hmm. Just because it's what you like?
Yeah, it's just my own personal preference.
Sure.
For instance, I wasn't going to stick around at Pixar to do Monsters, Inc. After
but
Toy
you
Story
did.
2. I went up to work on Toy Story 2, and once I finished that, I figured, you know, my job was done.
Mm-hmm.
And Pixar had this wonderful film about this monster world, and all these weird and goofy characters, and that just so grabbed me, I just had to work on that movie, because, you know, a movie about monsters, you know, how much fun can that be?
Mm-hmm.
It was just terrific. So that's my personal preference. But I know that there are other films that are maybe more sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
and that I enjoy just as much in a different way.
Okay.
But it's they wouldn't be my personal preference,
mm-hmm.
to work on them. Maybe somebody else would want to do that film and they could do it justice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll work on anything. It doesn't matter how serious or how stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I still enjoy the work. I still enjoy, you know, the medium.
Well, you like to weave a tale.
Huh?
You just like to weave a good tale.
Yeah, and I didn't even know I could do that. That's what I find so amazing with my
career.
But
Walt did.
Yeah, didn't he, though? Yeah.
Trust the old maestro.
Maybe he was right, but...
Clearly he was right, sir.
But I do love storytelling. I mean, I really do. I remember and when I was a kid in school in Santa Barbara, we used to have storytellers come in, and they would sit us all down in a little circle,
mm-hmm.
All of us little kids, and they would tell us stories. And I found that so fascinating. But I never thought I could do it. I never thought I could tell a story.
Who knew?
And there's so much about creating stories that I don't even understand how I do it. I just kind of sit down and do it. I really became aware of this when I went over to Disney Publishing in 1983, and my boss said I was a writer. And I thought, no, I'm not. I'm an artist. I'm a cartoonist. I'm not a writer. I don't write. And I suddenly realized that I couldn't think of myself as a writer, but I was a guy who just made up stories. So if that's writing, maybe that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when are we going to see some Bill Pete-style stories from Floyd Norman? Well, you clearly can draw, and you have that gift. So,
do you mean children's books?
Well, I mean, just whatever stories you feel like telling. Something in that, perhaps in that format, that's a melding of words and pictures.
Well, I thought I'd been doing that in my career. Yeah. I thought I was already doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Clearly, you're not producing enough. Paul Dini would
I'm dragging my feet. Yeah, clearly I'm not doing enough. Well, you know, I think maybe what I need is a budget. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not properly funded.
Yes.
I'm willing to make movies as long as I can find someone to pay for them.
A common problem for us all.
Yes.
Exactly. None of us That's are properly it. Yeah, funded. I'm willing to write the story. Now, one of the cool things I had about storytelling, when I went to Disney Publishing in 1983 and they told me I was a writer, which I didn't really believe them, but they said I was a writer. So they said, we want you to write stories for us. And I said, okay. And I found myself sitting down and I would just write. And I didn't even know how I was doing it. My boss would call me in and he would say, I need a 48-page goofy story. And I would go back to my desk and write a 48-page goofy story. And he would say, I need a Mickey Mouse detective story. Mickey Mouse and Goofy detective story. Okay, and I'd go back and I'd write a Mickey Mouse and Goofy detective story.
Mm-hmm.
And then when people asked me, well, how do you do that? And I thought, gee, I don't know. I just do it, you know. Yeah. I don't analyze it. Matter of fact, if I started to analyze it, then I probably couldn't do it.
Right.
I'm the same way. Yeah. People have asked me, where do your ideas come from? How do you write? And I said, I don't know.
I don't
know. One of the things about both of you guys, though, is you both do this. And I just from, you know, and I don't even know you really well, Floyd, but I love you already. I feel like I kind of get you. But it's interesting. You hang back and you observe. It's almost like you look at people and their behavior and situations that they're in, and it's something that you sort of, like, you can observe and understand, and you guys are both super empathetic, super emotionally available guys who know what it is to be a human being. And I don't know what your life was like when you were a little guy. I know you were drawing on walls, much to your mother's both delight and dismay.
Yes.
But I would guess that you've probably been through a lot of hardship because that makes you raw and observant and very available. And I know that Paul certainly has. And so I wonder if, as a writer, that's where part of it comes from for you specifically, is you're able to draw on personal experiences of both victories and failures, but also you watch people, so you have their stories in your bank without even realizing that you've been like a sponge absorbing the stories around you your whole life.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
You both do that. You know, that's you really possible. Do.
Although I must confess, and I almost feel bad saying this,
Definitely let it out.
Yeah.
Confess it to me, sir. I will build you a wooden box to talk to me through a little screen and all of it.
Yeah. I think I've been a very lucky kid because you mentioned hardship, and I know people who've had difficult lives and who've had hardship. I think I've been one of the kids who was just, I was just really lucky. I really didn't have hardship. I had a really happy childhood growing up in Santa Barbara. I loved high school. Most people hate high school because all the bad stuff happened to them in high school. And I only have good memories from high school.
Did you just maybe choose to take the good ones with you, though?
That's a possibility.
Because that's a choice.
But, I mean, I didn't come from poverty or...
I know.
Or a
you don't have to
drug-ridden
have a
family or my dad wasn't an alcoholic and I didn't have trauma, you know, to pull from. I just had this happy... idyllic Santa Barbara life, because everybody in Santa Barbara is rich and happy.
They are.
Yeah.
You know. Except for the ones that aren't.
Except for the ones, we weren't. But I had a lot of rich friends.
Rich friends have cool toys that you can borrow.
That's right. That counts for something. It's always good. Always good to have a wealthy friend in Hope Ranch or Montecito.
That's where
Hope Ranch.
That's where my mom was from.
Now you're talking. Cool.
Yeah.
And see us next week with part 3 of our Floyd Norman interviews. This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.